From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
성중앙통신사 보도. 권나라 전체 인민이.
North Korea announces it's carried out its first ever test of a nuclear weapon. The move has sparked a wave of international condemnation. We'll get the latest. Then one of Russia's most prominent journalists and human rights activists is shot dead in Moscow.
Anna Politkovskaya was arguably the best Russian investigative reporter living until Saturday.
We'll speak with Richard Behar of Forbes and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation. Then Florida Governor Jeb Bush is confronted by protesters in Pittsburgh when he comes to support Senator Rick Santorum. Police ushered Bush into a closet and tasered two of the protesters. We'll speak with one of the men tasered, as well as a member of the United Steelworkers who helped organize the protest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea's announced it has carried out its first ever test of a nuclear weapon. North Korea's official news agency declared the underground test a triumph and that it had not resulted in any leak of radiation. The test was widely condemned by the international community. The U.S. says the reported test is a provocative act. China expressed its resolute opposition to the test and said it, quote, defied the universal opposition of international society. Japan's new prime minister called the test unpardonable and said the region is, quote, entering a new dangerous nuclear age. South Korea's military ordered the army to step up a state of alert. Some analysts are warning North Korea's test may prompt Japan and South Korea to start their own nuclear weapon program. We'll have more on North Korea in a few minutes. In Iraq, the brother of the Iraqi vice president has been shot dead by gunmen in Baghdad. Amr al-Hashimi was a general in the Iraqi army. He was killed when gunmen dressed in police uniforms stormed his house. His brother, Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi, is a member of the Iraqi Islamic Party, the largest Sunni Muslim bloc in the Iraqi parliament. Earlier this year, another brother and Hashimi's sister were also murdered. Hundreds of Iraqi police officers have fallen sick after being apparently poisoned. The officers became ill Sunday evening after breaking their Ramadan fast. There are reports that 11 of the officers have died. In the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk, residents were barred from leaving their homes Saturday as security forces conducted house-to-house sweeps. No one in the city was allowed to drive or walk outside. In Baghdad, officials have begun efforts to seal off the city. Barricades and berm earth walls are being built around the city's edges as police seek to gain more control of who enters the city. Iraq's Interior Ministry has announced plans to set up 28 checkpoints into Baghdad. All other roads going into the city will be shut down. In Tal Afar, a suicide bomber blew up a truck, killing 14 people, including 10 civilians. President Bush hailed Tal Afar as a model Iraqi city 6 months ago. The Washington Post reports more U.S. soldiers were injured last month in Iraq, more than in any month since November 2004. 776 soldiers were wounded in action in September, another 300 wounded in the first week of October. Over 20,000 U.S. troops have been wounded so far in Iraq. 4,000 suffered wounds so severe they'll be affected for the rest of their lives. In Washington, there are reports former Secretary of State James Baker will soon recommend Iraq be carved up into three highly autonomous regions to create Kurdish, Shiite, and Sunni areas. Baker heads the Iraq Study Group, which was set up by Congress. NATO's top commander in Afghanistan is warning the country is at a tipping point and that the Taliban could soon have the support of the majority of Afghans. General David Richards said if life doesn't get better over the next 6 months, 70% of Afghans could switch sides and support the Taliban. Richards' comments come 5 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. On Saturday, two journalists working for the German news agency Deutsche Welle were killed in Afghanistan. They're the first foreign reporters to die there since late 2001. in Moscow. Hundreds of people gathered Sunday to protest the murder of one of the country's most prominent journalists and human rights activists. Anna Politkovskaya was shot dead on Saturday. She was a fierce critic of President Vladimir Putin and of the Chechen War. This is Vladimir Ryzhkov, an independent member of Russia's parliament.
There are literally only a few such journalists left in Russia, journalists who are frank and brave enough to write the truth about the murders and kidnappings in Chechnya, about the lies of the authorities, and about the corruption among high-ranking officials. The murder of such a journalist is an irreplaceable loss for Russia.
We'll have more on the journalist's deaths after headlines. Israel's actions during its attack on Lebanon continue to come under scrutiny. A top United Nations human rights expert says the International Criminal Court should investigate whether Israel's guilty of war crimes for a bombing campaign in Lebanon that blocked access to food and water. Jean Ziegler, the UN Human Rights Council's special envoy on the right to food, said the presence of unexploded cluster bombs could affect the ability of the Lebanese people to access food and water for years. The United Nations is reporting around 124 people in southern Lebanon have been killed or wounded by cluster bombs since Israel attack ended. The Israeli army fired at least 1.2 million cluster bomblets into Lebanon. In political news, Karl Rove's top aide has resigned after it was revealed she helped Jack Abramoff lobby the White House. The aide, Susan Ralston, served as Karl Rove's executive assistant. She formerly worked for Abramoff and got her White House job on Abramoff's recommendation. Ralston's resignation came just a week after the House Government Reform Committee documented 485 lobbying contacts between White House officials and Abramoff and his associates. Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman accused the White House of trying to make Ralston a scapegoat. Waxman said the links between the White House's former political director, Ken Mellman, and Abramoff deserve more scrutiny. Mellman is now chair of the Republican National Committee. Last week's report indicated Mellman was offered tickets to a rock concert and helped an Indian tribe represented by Abramoff secure $16 million for a jail, despite resistance from Justice Department officials. There are also new developments in the Mark Foley scandal. The Washington Post is reporting at least one Republican member of Congress knew 6 years ago that Foley was sending inappropriate internet messages to teenage boys who worked as pages on Capitol Hill. A spokesperson for Republican Congressmember Jim Colby confirmed the congressman first learned about Foley's actions in 2000. Meanwhile, one former House page has admitted he had sex with Foley. The former page was 21 at the time. The House Ethics Commission begins interviews on its inquiry into the Foley scandal today. In Argentina, as many as 100,000 protesters marched in Buenos Aires Friday, demanding the release of an elderly man who vanished after his testimony helped convict a former police officer. Jorge Julio López has been missing since September 18th, a day before former police commissioner Miguel Echecolatz was sentenced to life in prison for the murder, torture and kidnapping of six people during Argentina's dirty war. It's widely feared he may have been abducted and killed in an attempt to intimidate other witnesses from coming forward to talk about being tortured during the dirty war. One of the protesters on Friday was Tati Almeida. Her 20-year-old son, Alejandro, disappeared in 1975 at the hands of the Argentine military.
We're searching for truth. We're searching for justice. We're searching for Julio, for the 30,000 detained, disappeared, who are in our presence now and forever.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has asked President Bush to come clean about how the United States inappropriately treated Maher Arar. Arar is the Canadian citizen who was abducted by the United States after he had a layover at JFK in New York. He was first jailed at an immigration facility in New York, then transported to Syria against his wishes. He was jailed in Syria for almost a year and was tortured. Last month, the Canadian government report exonerated Arar and criticized the U.S. for its actions. The British human rights group Reprieve has accused the Bush administration of using a U.S. air base in Germany as a secret prison. Reprieve's legal director, Clive Stafford Smith, called on the German government to investigate the claims. He says, quote, no democracy should be taking part in crimes. There are new allegations of prisoner abuse at Guantanamo. The Associated Press reports a Marine has filed a sworn statement saying guards at the prison bragged to her about beating detainees. One guard reportedly admitted taking a prisoner by the head and hitting the prisoner's head into the cell door. Other guards talked about hitting prisoners, punching them in the face, and denying them water. The Marine said she learned of the abuse when she met with guards during a trip to the naval base at Guantanamo. The Marine said all the guards laughed at each other's stories of beating detainees. The Pentagon's announced it's investigating the report. In New Jersey, 1,400 prisoners are threatening to begin a hunger strike Wednesday if their living conditions aren't improved. Last week, the prisoners issued a series of demands saying they were being treated in a way, quote, reminiscent of Abu Ghraib. During recent lockdown, the prisoners said they were stripped of their underwear and forced to walk by barking, lunging dogs. The prisoners also complained about losing recreation time and a new ban on hardcover books. On Sunday, Pakistan marked the first anniversary of last year's earthquake that killed more than 73,000 people and left about 3.5 million people homeless. Hundreds of survivors of the earthquake rallied Saturday to protest outside Pakistan's parliament. They complained about government corruption at the State Earthquake Rehabilitation and Reconstruction Authority. This is Bushra Gohar, director of the Action Aid Earthquake Program.
Their real issues have not been taken into consideration. They have not been consulted in the development of their policies. And that is why these people have come here. Many of them are victims of extreme corruption by the officials who've got the responsibility to facilitate the reconstruction process.
And it has been revealed two prominent journalists took part in a secret meeting with the Bush administration in 2001 to help shape the country's response to the September 11th attacks. Then Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz organized the meeting in order to produce a report for President Bush outlining a strategy for dealing with Afghanistan and the Middle East in the aftermath of 9/11. The journalists attending the meeting were Fareed Zakaria and Robert Kaplan. Zakaria is the editor of Newsweek International and a Newsweek columnist. Kaplan's a writer for the Atlantic Monthly. They both signed confidentiality agreements not to discuss what happened at the secret meeting. Their role in the meeting was disclosed by Bob Woodward in his new book. Kaplan said his editor gave him permission to take part in the meeting. Kaplan defended his decision by saying that at the time, quote, everybody was in a patriotic fervor. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea says it's carried out its first ever test of a nuclear weapon, sparking a wave of condemnation from the international community. The apparent test was conducted at 10:36 a.m. Monday morning, Korea time. A senior U.S. official said China was given a 20-minute warning ahead of the test and in turn told the United States, Japan, and South Korea about getting the advance notice. The U.S. Geological Survey said it detected a tremor of 4.2 magnitude on the Korean Peninsula. Minutes later, North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency declared the underground test a triumph and had not resulted in any leak of radiation. The agency called it, quote, a historical event that has brought our military and our people huge joy, unquote. The move drew strong international condemnation. The U.S. said the reported test is a provocative act. China expressed its resolute opposition to the test and said it defied the universal opposition of international society. Japan's prime minister called the claimed test unpardonable and said the region was entering a new dangerous nuclear age. South Korea's military ordered the army to step up a state of alert. The UN Security Council urged North Korea last week not to carry out a test, warning of unspecified consequences if it did. Pyongyang pulled out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 2003 and has refused for a year to attend talks aimed at ending its nuclear ambitions. Today's test appeared linked to the ninth anniversary of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il's appointment as head of the Korean Workers' Party. And it came just one day before South Korean Foreign Minister Ban Ki-moon will face a vote on his bid to become the next Secretary General of the United Nations. Tim Shorrock is an independent journalist who's covered U.S.-Korean relations for decades. He joins me on the phone from his home in Tennessee. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the significance of this reported test?
Well, this is a monumental event for Korea, for the United States, for all the countries in that region of the world. But it's something that I don't think anyone is surprised at, really. This has been North Korea has been saying for years it's on the road to developing nuclear weapons. And it's tried desperately to use this, its possession of plutonium and then weapons, as a way to get bilateral talks with the United States to create a new relationship, they say, with the United States. 2 years ago, they brought in a group of U.S. scientists, and they actually showed them, you know, that they had made plutonium. So we know they've been on the road toward weaponry, and they finally have done it. This makes North Korea the eighth nuclear power in the world, which is a major development, particularly in a part of the world, the only place where nuclear weapons have ever been dropped in war.
Is there any reason to believe that this actually might not have happened?
Well, yes. I think that, like I said, the North Koreans have been demanding, jumping up and down, screaming they want bilateral talks with the United States. The Bush administration, from the get-go of this of Bush's term, has refused to talk with North Korea. At the beginning of the Bush administration, I think the idea was North Korea would kind of go away, would collapse of its own weight. People might remember that when the former president of South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, the longtime dissident who became the South Korean president in the late 90s and opened up really the first economic and political relationship between South and North Korea that has ever existed since the Korean War. When Kim Dae-jung came to the White House soon after Bush was sworn in, Bush publicly repudiated his policies, the so-called Sunshine policies, said North Korea is not to be trusted. And from that moment on, relations have deteriorated. Shortly after 9/11, the North Koreans decided to scrap their earlier agreement with the United States and started proceeding on this road, always saying they want to have discussions with the United States, bilateral talks. But this has been something that Bush has just simply refused to do.
The essential difference between how President Clinton has dealt with North Korea and President Bush has?
Well, the Clinton administration agreed to negotiate directly with the government. In 2000, the end of 2000, shortly before the change in administrations, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was in Pyongyang, North Korea. She actually met with the president of North Korea. At that time, the North Koreans and the United States had an agreement under which North Korea would suspend its nuclear program in return for economic assistance and a better relationship with the United States. And when Albright was in Pyongyang on that visit, there was discussions towards a treaty, toward an agreement that would stop North Korea's testing and manufacturing of missiles. And those negotiations were stopped cold when Bush came in. And his administration has refused to have any direct negotiations with the North Koreans. And all the countries that are part of these six-party talks, Russia, China, Japan, particularly Russia and China and South Korea, of course, have been all the time saying there must be direct talks. Please have direct talks. This is the only way to resolve this, because the North sees the conflict not with other countries but directly with the United States. And they see their survival at stake, and they see nuclear weapons as the only way to guarantee their survival.
It's very interesting that this should come at a time where the U.S. has upped the pressure on, well, not North Korea, but on Iran. So the place that doesn't have nuclear weapons, they have been focusing the most attention on, when all indications were this is the path that North Korea was on.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, I mean, all this time there's been, of course, planning and background discussions, but the Bush administration has been very deliberate about keeping this, you know, out of the headlines, de-emphasizing what's been going on there because it's so trapped up in Iraq and then planning for whatever it's going to do in Iran. And I think that this is a serious mistake. This shows the complete failure of Bush's policies in Northeast Asia.
Tim Shorrock, let's talk about China and Japan. It was China that alerted the United States once North Korea told China that it was about to test this nuclear bomb yesterday.
Right. Well, the U.S. has been counting on China to sort of, you know, curtail whatever North Korea is doing, put the pressure on North Korea. North Korea and China are very close allies. During the Korean War, the Chinese entered the war to prevent the United States from basically occupying and taking control of all of Korea. They pushed the United States back to the 38th parallel. They lost millions of soldiers. That relationship is very strong and remains very strong. The Chinese are, of course, concerned about this, what would happen if North Korea got nuclear weapons, that Japan might obtain them afterwards, and so on. And they put out a very strong statement today, critical of this test. However, because of this relationship, and we have to remember that the same neocons who got us into Iraq and are pushing to get the United States involved in Iran, they see China as a strategic challenge, i.e. the real enemy. And there's been this intense game in Asia for the last 5 or 10 years between the Chinese and the United States for influence. And you sort of have China, not directly allied, but sort of in the same circles now, economically and politically, surprisingly, with South Korea, with North Korea. Even a lot of Southeast Asian nations have developed close ties with China. And then on the other hand, you have the U.S. and Japan building up their militaries together in ways that are trying to counter China. And so there was this whole dynamic of the Chinese also being concerned about challenges to them and seeing North Korea as an ally in this fight. There's a very interesting piece that's been quoted widely today that was written by a scholar in China called Sheng Ding Li that lays out China's ties with North Korea and why a nuclear test would serve the interests of North Korea and it might actually serve the interests of China. This person argues that basically North Korea has forced the United States to put thousands of troops and missiles and other forces in South Korea, in the sort of northeast part of China, which means that they're not focusing so much force near Taiwan, and that's good for China in the long run. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get China to actually, you know, reject everything with its relationship with North Korea and turn against them. So it's going to be an interesting period over the next few days and weeks to see how this happens, because I don't think you're really going to get China to make North Korea into an enemy and allow. They may go along with some kind of economic sanctions, but beyond that, I really doubt that they would be in favor of using force or, you know, naval blockades and things like that.
Tim Shorrock, finally, and we just have 30 seconds. This happening the day before what's happening today, the South Korean foreign minister, Ban Ki-moon, being voted on for his bid for the next Secretary General of the United Nations. That's happening today.
Well, let's remember the last time when they tested missiles was on July 4th, so they know the symbolic timing of this. And it's also interesting that the Japanese Prime Minister Abe is in Seoul the same day. And, I think Japan's role here is also very critical. Abe's predecessor, after all, had enraged China, enraged South Korea and many other countries by visiting the shrine where the Japanese war criminals are buried. And I think Japanese ties with China and the Koreas are very tenuous because of this. So this is not a good time to have a large U.S.-led alliance against North Korea. It's going to take some time, but I think the only thing that's going to stop this from becoming a full-blown crisis is for the United States to have direct talks with North Korea.
Tim Shorrock, I want to thank you very much for being with us, independent journalist who's covered U.S.-Korean relations for over 20 years, lived in Korea for years as well. His reports have appeared in The Nation and Mother Jones and Harper's Magazine. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about a Russian journalist who was assassinated over the weekend. Stay with us. Oh, Arirang here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish and transcript and audio form for any radio station to take at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was shot dead in her apartment in Moscow. She was a correspondent for Novaya Gazeta newspaper and was an outspoken critic of the Kremlin and its policies in Chechnya. Her reporting on the Second Chechen War, torture, mass executions, and kidnappings by Russian soldiers made her into one of the country's most prominent human rights advocates. Anna was the author of the book A Small Corner of Hell, Dispatches from Chechnya. Her latest book, Putin's Russia, was a fierce indictment of Russia's corrupt politics and had just been published in the U.S. She also acted as a negotiator with the Chechen rebels who laid siege to a Moscow theater in 2002. Here she is speaking at the time.
The guerrillas intended to stay inside the theater to the bitter end, and were expecting it to be stormed eventually by Russian forces. They have not made any demands for money, and there will not be any. They came here to die, and they are waiting for the storming to die in battle.
In the days before her death, Anna Politkovskaya had been working on a story about torture in the government of Ramzan Kadyrov, the pro-Kremlin premier of Chechnya. The article was expected to be published today. This is fellow journalist Vyacheslav Ismailov speaking about Anna yesterday.
Without any doubt, the primary version is her work in Chechnya and in human rights organizations, her work on saving people. She helped a lot. And there were threats directed against Anna.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says since 2000, 12 journalists in Russia have been killed in contract-style murders. Katrina Vandenhoevel joins us now. She's the editor of The Nation magazine, longtime analyst of U.S.-Russian relations. And we're joined by journalist Richard Behar. He is the director of Project Khlebnikov, a global media network dedicated to investigating the 2004 murder of Paul Khlebnikov, who was the editor-in-chief of the Russian edition of Forbes magazine. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Katrina, can you talk about Anna, please?
Well, Anna was intense, brave, courageous reporter whose mission was to document and chronicle the human catastrophe of the war in Chechnya. This is a war, Amy, which since 1994, in the first and second phases of this war, has killed perhaps 100,000 civilians. But she spoke to, she was one of the few remaining independent correspondents. She worked for one of the few remaining opposition newspapers, Novaya Gazeta, because the media landscape in Russia today is in some ways reminiscent of this country because oligarchs control so many of the papers. On the other hand, state control of television, I think, is now the real impediment to independent reporting. The state now controls the television, and 85% of Russians get their news from television. The last thing I'd say is you talked about how 12 journalists have been executed, killed since 2000. What we can't forget is that since 1992, 42 Russian journalists have been killed in contract-style executions, almost all of their murders unresolved. So it's important to see this as a span since 92, and so much of it is connected to the corruption of this brutal war, what Anna wrote about, the brutality of a war that is a cancer in Russian society and that betrays what Putin claims is his ability to bring security and stability to a country. Because since 2002, over 1,000 Russians have been killed in terrorist acts, direct responses to an occupation of Chechnya.
Did you know Anna personally?
I knew her a little. I met her in Moscow. I met her in New York. And she was intense. She was aware of the risks she faced, but she was never fearful because she believed it was the duty of a journalist to report on the truth and reality. And she had a sense of a higher mission. Some journalists in Russia, I fear, felt she was obsessed, had become fanatical in her crusade. But as you see on the streets, the hundreds of people protesting her death suggests this could be a tipping point of sorts, because what's so crucial, and we were talking earlier, is that Russian journalists unify, organize, that there be some solidarity. That may be very hard to accomplish, but it's going to be needed if Russian journalism can retain some independence in the face of a growing authoritarianism.
Richard Behar, you have established this project that deals with another journalist who was killed.
Yes, Project Khlebnikov, which was launched last year on the one-year anniversary of the murder of Paul Khlebnikov, the editor of Forbes Russia. And we are also looking into the other murders that have taken place. And I'm sorry to have to be here in light of Anna's murder 2 days ago. I met and spoke with Anna over the past year, and she was actually assisting us in putting together a Russian force of journalists that could work with us in some of these cases. And there are very few left who I think are actually suitable candidates at this point. No one's doing this kind of investigative report. Very few are.
Do we know who killed her?
No, and this unfortunately reminds me of how I felt 2 years ago when my friend Paul was killed, because the list of candidates is endless. In her book, in Anna's book about Putin, she attacked him pretty harshly. In her books about Chechnya and her work, she has gone after all kinds of Chechen leaders. It's been very well known throughout Russia that her campaign against Kadyrov, who is the prime minister, has been very, very intense. So some suspect that he or his forces could be involved. His camp is saying that this has so hurt him, since he would be considered a suspect, that she could have been killed by people trying to discredit him.
Think about the irony. I don't know if that's the right word, because we are now in this country, in America, consumed with discussions of torture. At least independent media outlets are doing a lot to expose the abuses and to understand how it flows from the top. And that is what Anna was working on when she was killed, an important investigative article about torture she alleged committed by security forces loyal to the Chechen prime minister. The article, it appears, is not to be found. I had hoped that the editors of Novaya Gazeta had it in their computers. Several photographs of those alleged to be implicated are gone. I would simply say that at this moment, she's going to be buried tomorrow. She's going to be buried in a cemetery which I've visited, next to a young reporter, Dmitry Holodov, who was killed before 2000 for his reporting, investigative reporting, on the corruption of military equipment. This is a terrible pattern, and it's important that all weight be brought to bear, international journalistic weight be brought to bear, to bring her murderer to justice. But Novaya Gazeta, I would say again, having visited that paper, having worked with editors at that paper, it's very important that we support the remaining independent outlets. It's interesting that the father of Glasnost, the former Russian president, Mikhail Gorbachev, who called her killing a savage crime, a crime against the independent media, against our country, is a minority owner in that newspaper. Whether that protects it, gives it any protection, or whether that means we're going to see more of a conflict in the political class will be interesting to watch.
Just days before her murder, she spoke on Moscow radio, and you know, again, it reminds me of Paul, because she's just so tenacious and so courageous and brazen at times. But she said that Kadyrov, the prime minister of the Russian-supported prime minister, Putin-supported of Chechnya, she called him a coward armed to the teeth and surrounded by bodyguards. She said, "I have two photographs on my desk now. These photos are of his torture chambers today and in the past, and people who were kidnapped for no clear reasons." And she went on and on talking about it. This was just days before Saturday. That was Anna.
I think she also understood and spoke eloquently about how what she called the Bush-Blair War gave cover to Putin, who called his war in Chechnya a war against international terrorism, when in fact so many analysts understand that it's the occupation of Chechnya which has fueled and engendered the very terrorism Anna feared and which she tried to defuse when she was stepped outside of her journalistic role to be a mediator in that horrible Moscow theater hostage crisis.
Didn't she believe she was poisoned there?
She believed she was poisoned on the way to Beslan, another tragedy your listeners may remember at the school, where I think some 300 people, including so many children, were killed. You know, it's not the first time. There's another reporter I knew a little named Yuri Chekachikin, an investigative reporter who worked for Novaya Gazeta, who was poisoned. I know his wife a little, who runs the Union of Journalists Committee. And what's the Novaya Gazeta funded its own investigation because it didn't trust the government investigation. And in this case, the same thing. The paper is committed to supporting an investigation. And one of the owners of the paper has put up 25 million rubles, $1 million, to help flush out, bring to justice the murder.
What is Bush's role with Putin?
Bush and Putin have had discussions that I'm aware of about this over the past couple of years, but we have not heard Putin address these murders of journalists in any way. The State Department has been very vocal. The U.S. government has asked Russia repeatedly to allow them to help investigate the Khlebnikov murder, for example, and Russia has continuously refused. I believe the Kremlin's been silent also since Anna's murder.
I have to say,
it's a pattern that we see, and I think the country and certainly the journalism community could use hearing from President Putin. It would be very helpful at such a miserable, awful, and confusing time.
I think Putin should address this. I think he should meet with journalists, more than meet, but really lay his authority on the line in terms of investigations. But I have to say that I think the United States does best by example and not by preaching and not by getting involved, certainly at a governmental level, in these issues. The journalistic community internationally could play a valuable role, but keep it out of the government's hand. I don't think at a moment when the United States' reputation in terms of democracy issues, not to draw equivalences here, is so tarnished, that this country has a right to go around preaching journalistic democracy to others.
Wasn't there this interesting moment in a Putin-Bush press conference about the issue of freedom of the press?
They always get it a little mangled because, Putin talked something. I think he talked about Dan Rather and his case as if CBS was state-controlled. CBS is a flawed network, has a lot of problems, but we're not looking at the equivalent of our TV networks being taken over by state companies, private companies. That is a Russian problem, which there is an equivalence, because the oligarchs, so many of them, have taken over newspapers and other media outlets for their own purposes.
The last wonderful TV outlet, independent, was Ren TV, and in fact, they were going to participate in our project in the investigation, and they are now taken over and more or less silenced and in the hands of Kremlin-controlled people.
The sadness is that democracy has become a bad word in much of Russia. Let's be honest. Putin, much of it may be the control of state television, has popularity ratings ranging between 90% and 75%.
Sky high. And as long as oil and gas revenues are flowing in tremendously, I was in Russia this summer and I could see how well people were doing on the streets. And if you look at survey after survey in Russia, they'd rather have a strong state than a free press.
He has become the proponent, the proselytizer of a strong state. But just to contradict Richard a little, I think what democracy is associated with is the demodernization of a country, because some 60% of Russians live in poverty, according to government statistics, and that is linked to the looting of a country, which is the greatest fire sale of the 20th century, so that so much, 33 billionaires in Russia. We lost that in the Forbes list a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
Where does that money come from? They've seized the assets of the state, and Putin, with all the flaws and the authoritarianism, is trying to retrieve some of those assets. The question is, will he use it for the people? That remains completely unresolved. And in this case, with the war, the cancer in this country, until that is resolved, there will be very little stability.
And finally, the situation in Chechnya today.
The situation in Chechnya is brutal. I mean, the possibilities of negotiation have been lost, the radicalization of both sides, the anger, the brutality.
The press is largely kept out.
Yeah, the press did play a role in 94, 96 in that first round of war when it was ended in a form of negotiation because MTV television was really vibrant at that stage. But the possibilities of stability and security, think of the killing of the central banker, Andrei Kozlov, just a few weeks ago for his attempt to shut down banks involved in money laundering. Contract killings in the streets of Moscow, this is not a model.
And this was a direct attack on Putin.
Yeah, this is why.
This is one of your own reformers going after money laundering, reigning in banks, really on the cutting edge. And in a sense, these murderers are saying, we can do what we want.
Impurity,
what are you going to do
impurity.
About it?
But I have to say, you know, the Washington Post yesterday published an editorial basically attributing Anna Politkovskaya's brutal murder to the climate of brutality Putin, a KGB agent, as they wrote, has created. It may well be, and we don't know, that this is an attack on Putin because there are many elements which hated Anna Politkovskaya, rogue elements, elements in the security ministries, which might like to destabilize Putin. There is a battle underway, even in this closed, increasingly closed political society.
In Anna's book, Putin's Russia, she wrote, "What is it that makes me dislike him, Putin, so much as to feel moved to write a book about him? Putin, a product of the country's murkiest intelligence service, has failed to transcend his origins and stop behaving like a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet KGB. He is still busy sorting out his freedom-loving fellow countrymen. He persists in crushing liberty, just as he did earlier in his career."
So tomorrow, the funeral for Anna.
It will be an extraordinary event. I have attended, I mean, I attended the, it wasn't a murder, but I've been to journalists' funerals. This will be at a cemetery, as I said, where she will be, she may well be buried next to this young journalist who all know was killed with no resolution. I suspect hundreds and hundreds of people will come out to say we will not permit this assassination to send a chill through pro-democracy, human rights activists' hearts in the community. But here's the question. Will it be shown on television? I've been trying to get in touch with Russian friends to ask how much of this has been on television. Again, like in our country, 85% get their news. Novaya Gazeta is wonderful, but, you know, it's like The Nation. It's 170,000-180,000 in a country massive. But let's protect places like Novaya Gazeta and allow them to flourish because they remain outposts of real journalism.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for
being
with us. Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, longtime analyst on U.S.-Russian relations, and Richard Behar, investigative journalist, spent 9 years with Fortune. Before that was a reporter for Time and Forbes. He's the director now of Project Khlebnikov. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Pittsburgh to look at the senatorial race in Pennsylvania. Stay with us. Shostakovich, Cello Concerto in D minor here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Florida Governor Jeb Bush was confronted by protesters on the streets of Pittsburgh on Friday. Police responded by ushering Governor Bush into a closet and tasering two of the protesters. The Florida governor was in Pittsburgh to attend a fundraiser for Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum. A crowd of demonstrators made up of United Steelworkers and members of Uprise Counter-Recruitment were there to greet him. They followed Governor Bush as he was making his way to the Duquesne Club in downtown Pittsburgh.
He was accompanied by a security guard and an aide. As the protesters came closer, Bush retreated toward a nearby subway station. The crowd followed him inside, chanting, "We don't want you here," and "Jeb, go home." Port Authority spokesperson Bob Grove told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that six or seven officers responded to the scene. He said the crowd was asked repeatedly to disperse. Two officers used their tasers on two of the protesters. The police ushered Jeb Bush into a supply closet where he stayed there until the crowd left. No arrests were made, no citations issued. John Vandenberg, researcher for the United Steelworkers, was at the protest, joining us from a studio in Pittsburgh. Also on the phone, we're joined by one of the two protesters who were tasered. He asked not to be identified. We're also joined on the phone by Al Neary, editor of The Insider, a biweekly newspaper, newsletter on Pennsylvania politics. Let's begin with John Vandenberg. Can you describe how this protest went down, and where were you, John?
Sure, Amy, and thanks for having me today. Basically, the protest happened. We found out a couple of days in advance that there would be a fundraiser at the Duquesne Club in Pittsburgh that Jeb Bush would be attending. We decided we would gather a crowd of union members, not just steelworkers, but people from the Transit Workers Union and SEIU and other unions, in the lobby of the Steelworkers Building, which is a few blocks from the Duquesne Club, and march over to the site of the fundraiser. And then along the way, we sort of fortuitously came across Jeb Bush on a street corner. Somebody said, "Hey, there he is," and he was just across the street from us. And so we started chanting and yelling at him from across the street. And it seemed that there was going to be this change where we were on one side of the street and he was on the other. And then he blew us a kiss, and that seemed to sort of trigger an anger in our crowd of demonstrators. That then sort of sparked us to head out into traffic and cross the street and start making our way towards him. So he pretty quickly, I think, changed his mind about whether or not he wanted to engage with the crowd. And I wouldn't call it a trot necessarily, but he certainly was uncomfortably moving down the sidewalk with his aides sort of flanking him in the rear. And we were right on his heels, and a couple of members of our group, in fact, were maybe getting in front of him and getting in his face. And he ducked into a subway station like you described in the introduction, and we had him pinned up against the wall, really, chanting with signs. A crowd, I think of about 30 or 40 of us, actually went down into this subway station in Pittsburgh and had him pinned against the wall with his staff in a corner chanting at him. You know, there was certainly no violence on our part, but we were very close and very loud and letting him know in no uncertain terms how we felt about him being in Pittsburgh. And then the police showed up and had a key that unlocked a supply closet, and a couple of members of our group got tasered, and they were just about ready to unveil the pepper spray and German Shepherds when we decided, I think, collectively that we would get out of there.
Huh. I'd like to turn to the person who doesn't want to be identified, who got tasered. First, why don't you want to say your name?
I feel that in the current security situation in the United States, with specifically the terrorism bill that was passed last week, that's very dangerous for demonstrators, specifically anarchists, specifically radicals, to identify themselves in the media. The U.S. government has been cracking down on anarchist activists for a while, and I don't really feel like ending up in prison, and I really want to be on the streets doing stuff. So I feel that this is for my own safety and the safety of my collective.
And what is your collective?
We decided that we wish not to be named in the interview.
Can you talk about what happened?
Well, I think the description of the event was pretty accurate. When we charged down into the subway basement, when we seized the lobby and then charged down to the subway basement, they kind of pushed Jeb Bush to a closet, which at which point I boosted myself up on a marble ledge and started screaming out, and then got my arm pulled back behind my back by a cop, and then tasered by another cop, and then pulled out by, other demonstrators, pulled away from the grasp of the police, and caught my balance and walked upstairs and out. From what I understand, the picket outside maintained itself throughout that entire situation, and that's really important. I mean, that provided a lot of support for the people who are willing to take direct action to prevent Jeb Bush from getting where he needed to go.
When you say tasered, explain exactly what happened and what that means.
Well, a taser is different than a stun gun. They keep saying that it was a stun gun. But a taser, it's like a yellow or black gun-looking thing. It's plastic. It shoots out two wires that have barbs on the end that hook into your skin, and then fires electrical charges into you. I didn't get hit with the full voltage. You drop the full voltage cartridge. But essentially, when you get hit with a taser, every muscle in your body bunches up, and you can't control your movements at all. So when I got pulled back, the taser came out of my body, which allowed me to regain my balance and keep moving. But the effects of that are pretty long-lasting. I was hazy and couldn't concentrate on anything for about a day, and, like, my whole body hurts now and things like that. It's a pretty vicious weapon. People have died because of it.
And what are your plans now?
Well, my plans are to continue on with the activities that we're doing, which, you know, include continuing to be an activist. But right now I'm trying to take care of myself the best I can because it was a pretty it's pretty traumatic when you get tasered. It's not an easy thing to deal with.
Al Neary is also on the line with us, editor of The Insider, a biweekly newsletter on Pennsylvania politics. Can you put this protest in Pittsburgh in the larger context of what is happening today in the senatorial race? Jeb Bush in Pittsburgh for a fundraiser for Senator Santorum in a very close race to try to keep his seat. He's up against Bob Casey.
Sure. First, can I asked a basic question of the protesters, and that is, were they protesting Senator Santorum or were they protesting Governor Bush indirectly for the actions of his brother, President Bush?
Repeat that point.
Oh, were they protesting Senator Santorum or were they protesting Governor Bush for the actions of President Bush?
John Vandenberg.
Sure. I think I can say we're equal opportunity protesters. I think the labor movement certainly has a beef against both individuals. Governor Bush for his role, obviously, in the 2000 election and his support of his brother's administration, and Senator Santorum for a whole raft of votes during his tenure in the Senate that have been bad for working people in Pennsylvania and all over the country. So I think, you know, the answer to your question was we set out to protest the Santorum fundraiser. And the fact that Jeb Bush was there was, I suppose, an incentive for Santorum donors to show up and buy a plate at this meal or speech or whatever it was. But it was also an incentive for us, I think, to turn out a larger crowd. It was an opportunity with a high-profile person in town to send a strong message about where we're coming from as the labor movement.
But Al Neary, for our national audience, we only have 2 minutes, and I just want to wonder if you can give us a thumbnail sketch of what the issues are, what the polls indicate right now between Santorum and Casey, and where they stand. What are the key issues that they differ on?
There's really no key issue. The issue is Senator Santorum. This whole election is a referendum on Senator Santorum. And what's changed since his last election in 2000 is that the senator has been on a downward spiral. It started with 2004 when he supported moderate Republican Senator Specter, and that shook up Senator Santorum's conservative base. He responded with a book that was to shore up his conservative base, but ended up riling working women when he suggested that that there should be only one parent working when raising children, and then it continued on with a controversy about his children being cyber schooled at the expense of Pennsylvania taxpayers when they were living in Virginia, and it's just been a downward spiral since then. And what's happened is that the polling shows that Senator Santorum can't get past 40% support. Bob Casey, the state treasurer and son of the former governor, his support, you know, wavers between 50 and 60%. A large part of his support is just pure opposition to Senator Santorum. So the race is purely a referendum on Senator Santorum. Senator Santorum can't seem to jack up his numbers beyond 40%, and barring some political miracle, he will be out of the Senate in January.
Al Neri of The Insider, John Vandenberg, researcher for United Steelworkers, and the person on the phone, the protester. I want to thank you all for being with us as we end our show on another continent, in South Africa. The Archbishop Desmond Tutu turned 75 years old Saturday. Over 1,200 people gathered for a gala dinner in Johannesburg. Former South African President Nelson Mandela praised the Nobel Peace Prize winner for his leadership during the days of apartheid and for heading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Desmond Tutu, as chairperson of the GRC, became the symbol and embodiment of our nation striving to rise out of the horrors of our divided past and to unite around our common humanity. Under his leadership, the GRC became an example and a source of inspiration to the entire world. South Africa continues to be an example of what can be achieved in circumstances of conflict if there is the will and commitment to finding peaceful solutions.
Former South African President Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, also spoke at Saturday's dinner marking his 75th birthday.
We were struggling to push aside the body so that we could become truly human, all of us. Human beings who knew just how much we need one another.
That was Archbishop Desmond Tutu on his 75th birthday. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shruf Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Maté, Jen Yutz. Nick Marsilio is our engineer. Thanks also to Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Peter Yoon. I'll be in Buffalo on Wednesday night at State University of New York, Buffalo. You can go to our website for further Breaking the Sound Barrier tour details this weekend in Tucson, Arizona. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Also, special thanks to Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Megan Whitney, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin. Thanks for joining us.